Chapter 5. The German Air Fleet, one of all the productions of the human imagination that make the world in which Mr. Bert Smallways lived confusingly wonderful, there was none quite so strange, so headlong and disturbing, so noisy and persuasive and dangerous, as the modernizations of patriotism produced by imperial and international politics. In the soul of all men, is a liking for kind, a pride in one's own atmosphere, a tenderness for one's mother speech, and one's familiar land. Before the coming of the scientific age, this group of gentle and noble emotions had been a fine factor in the equipment of every worthy human being, a fine factor that had its less amiable aspect in a usually harmless hostility to strange people, and a usually harmless detraction of strange lands. But with the wild rush of change in the pace, scope, materials, scale, and possibilities of human life that then occurred, the old boundaries, the old seclusions and separations were violently broken down. All the old settled mental habits and traditions of men found themselves not simply confronted by new conditions, but by constantly renewed and changing new conditions. They had no chance of adapting themselves. They were annihilated or perverted or inflamed beyond recognition. Bert Smallway's grandfather, in the days when Bun Hill was a village under the sway of Sir Peter Bone's parent, had known his place to the uttermost farthing, touched his hat to his betters, despised and condescended to his inferiors, and hadn't changed an idea from the cradle to the grave. He was Kentish and English, and that meant hops, beer, dog roses, and the sort of sunshine that was best in the world. Newspapers and politics and visits to Annan weren't for the likes of him. Then came the change. These earlier chapters have given an idea of what happened to Bun Hill, and how the flood of novel things had poured over its devoted rusticity. Bert Smallways was only one of countless millions in Europe and America and Asia who, instead of being born rooted in the soil, were born struggling in a torrent they never clearly understood. All the faiths of their fathers had been taken by surprise and startled into the strangest forms and reactions. Particularly did the fine old tradition of patriotism get perverted and distorted in the rush of the new times. Instead of the sturdy establishment in prejudice of Bert's grandfather, to whom the word Renchified was the ultimate term of contempt, there flowed through Bert's brain a squittering succession of thinly violent ideas about German competition, about the yellow danger, about the black peril, about the white man's burthen, that is to say, Bert's preposterous right to muddle further the naturally very muddled politics of the entirely similar little cats to himself, except for a smear of brown, who smoked cigarettes and rode bicycles in Bulawayo, Kingston, Jamaica, or Bombay. These were Bert's abject races, and he was ready to die by proxy in the person of anyone who cared to enlist to maintain his hold upon that right. It kept him awake at nights to think that he might lose it. The essential fact of the politics of the age in which Bert Smallways lived, the age that blundered at last into the catastrophe of the war in the air, was a very simple one, if only people had had the intelligence to be simple about it. The development of science had altered the scale of human affairs. By means of rapid mechanical traction, it had brought men nearer together, so much nearer socially, economically, physically, that the old separations into nations and kingdoms were no longer possible. A newer, wider synthesis was not only needed, but imperatively demanded. Just as the once independent dukedoms of France had to fuse into a nation, so now the nations had to adapt themselves to a wider coalescence. They had to keep what was precious and possible, and concede what was obsolete and dangerous. A saner world would have perceived this patent need for a reasonable synthesis, would have discussed it temperately, achieved and gone on to organize the great civilization that was manifestly possible to mankind. The world of Bert Smallways did nothing of the sort. Its national governments, its national interests, would not hear of anything so obvious, They were too suspicious of each other, too wanting in generous imaginations. They began to behave like ill-bred people in a crowded public car, to squeeze against one another, elbow, thrust, dispute, and quarrel. Vain to point out to them that they had only to rearrange themselves to be comfortable. Everywhere, all over the world, the historian of the early 20th century finds the same thing, the flow and rearrangement of human affairs inextricably entangled by the old areas, the old prejudices and a sort of heated irascible stupidity, and everywhere congested nations in inconvenient areas, slopping population and producing to each other, annoying each other with tariffs, and every possible commercial vexation, and threatening each other with navies and armies, that grew every year more portentous. It is impossible now to estimate how much of the intellectual and physical energy of the world was wasted in military preparation and equipment, but it was an enormous proportion. Great Britain spent upon army and navy money and capacity that directed into the channels of physical culture and education would have made the British the aristocracy of the world. Her rulers could have kept the whole population learning and exercising up to the age of 18, and made a broad-chested and intelligent man of every Bert Smallways in the islands, had they given the resources they spent in war material to the making of men. Instead of which they waggled flags at him until he was 14, incited him to cheer, and then turned him out of school, to begin that career of private enterprise we have compactly recorded. France achieved similar imbecilities. Germany was, if possible, worse. Russia, under the waste and stresses of militarism, festered towards bankruptcy and decay. All Europe was producing big guns, and countless swarms of little small ways. The Asiatic peoples had been forced in self-defense into a like diversion of the new powers science had brought them. On the eve of the outbreak of the war there were six great powers in the world, and a cluster of smaller ones, each armed to the teeth and straining every nerve, to get ahead of the others in deadliness of equipment and military efficiency. The great powers were first the United States, a nation addicted to commerce, but roused to military necessities by the efforts of Germany to expand into South America, and by the natural consequences of her own unwary annexations of land in the very teeth of Japan. She maintained two immense fleets east and west, and internally she was in violent conflict between federal and state governments upon the question of universal service in a defensive militia. Next came the Great Alliance of Eastern Asia, a close-knit coalescence of China and Japan, advancing with rapid strides year by year, to predominance in the world's affairs. Then the German alliance still struggled to achieve its dream of imperial expansion, and its imposition of the German language upon a forcibly united Europe. These were the three most spirited and aggressive powers in the world. Far more pacific was the British Empire, perilously scattered over the globe, and distracted now by insurrectionary movements in Ireland, and among all its subject races. It had given these subject races cigarettes, boots, bowler hats, cricket, race meetings, cheap revolvers, petroleum, the factory system of industry, half-puny newspapers in both English and the vernacular, inexpensive university degrees, motor bicycles and electric trams. It had produced a considerable literature expressing contempt for the subject races, and rendered it freely accessible to them, and it had been content to believe that nothing would result from these stimulants, because somebody once wrote the immemorial East, and also, in the inspired words of Kipling, East is East and West is West, and never the twain shall meet. Instead of which, Egypt, India, and the subject countries generally had produced new generations in a state of passionate indignation and the utmost energy, activity, and modernity. The governing class in Great Britain was slowly adapting itself to a new conception of the subject races as waking peoples, and finding its efforts to keep the empire together under these strains and changing ideas greatly impeded by the entirely sporting spirit with which Bert Smallways at home, by the million, cast his vote, and by the tendency of his more highly colored equivalents, to be disrespectful to irascible officials. Their impertinence was excessive. It was no mere stone throwing and shouting. They would quote Burns at them, and Mill and Darwin, and confute them in arguments. Even more pacific than the British Empire were France and its allies, the Latin powers, heavily armed states indeed, but reluctant warriors, and in many ways socially and politically leading Western civilization. Russia was a pacific power perforce, divided within itself, torn between revolutionaries and reactionaries who were equally incapable of social reconstruction, and so sinking towards a tragic disorder of chronic political vendetta. Wedged in among these portentous larger bulks, swayed and threatened by them, the smaller states of the world maintained a precarious independence, each keeping itself armed as dangerously as its utmost ability could contrive. So it came about that in every country a great and growing body of energetic and inventive men was busied either for offensive or defensive ends, in elaborating the apparatus of war, until the accumulating tensions should reach the breaking point. Each power sought to keep its preparation secret, to hold new weapons in reserve, to anticipate and learn the preparations of its rivals. The feeling of danger from fresh discoveries affected the patriotic imagination of every people in the world. Now it was rumored the British had an overwhelming gun, now the French an invincible rifle, now the Japanese a new explosive, now the Americans a submarine that would drive every ironclad from the seas. Each time there would be a war panic. The strength and heart of the nations was given to the thought of war, and yet the mass of their citizens was a teeming democracy as heedless of and unfitted for fighting, mentally, morally, physically, as any population has ever been, or, one ventures to add, could ever be. That was the paradox of the time. It was a period altogether unique in the world's history. The apparatus of warfare, the art and method of fighting, changed absolutely every dozen years in a stupendous progress towards perfection, and people grew less and less warlike, and there was no war. And then at last it came. It came as a surprise to all the world, because its real causes were hidden. Relations were strained between Germany and the United States, because of the intense exasperation of a tariff conflict, and the ambiguous attitude of the former power towards the Monroe Doctrine, and they were strained between the United States and Japan, because of the perennial citizenship question. But in both cases these were standing causes of offense. The real deciding cause, it is now known, was the perfecting of the Pforzheim engine by Germany, and the consequent possibility of a rapid and entirely practicable airship. At that time Germany was by far the most efficient power in the world, better organized for swift and secret action, better equipped with the resources of modern science, and with her official and administrative classes at a higher level of education and training. These things she knew, and she exaggerated that knowledge to the pitch of contempt for the secret counsels of her neighbors. It may be that with the habit of self-confidence her spying upon them had grown less thorough. Moreover, as he had a tradition of unsentimental and unscrupulous action that vitiated her international outlook profoundly. With the coming of these new weapons her collective intelligence thrilled with the sense that now her moment had come. Once again in the history of progress it seemed she held the decisive weapon. Now she might strike and conquer before the others had anything but experiments in the air. Particularly she must strike America, swiftly, because there, if anywhere, lay the chance of an aerial rival. It was known that America possessed a flying machine of considerable practical value, developed out of the Wright model, but it was not supposed that the Washington War Office had made any wholesale attempts to create an aerial navy. It was necessary to strike before they could do so. France had a fleet of slow navigables, several dating from 1908, that could make no possible headway against the new type. They had been built solely for reconnoitering purposes on the eastern frontier. They were mostly too small to carry more than a couple of dozen men without arms or provisions, and not one could do 40 miles an hour. Great Britain, it seemed, in an excess of meanness, temporized and wrangled with the imperial spirited Butteridge and his extraordinary invention. That also was not in play, and could not be for some months at the earliest. From Asia there came no sign. The Germans explained this by saying the yellow peoples were without invention. No other competitor was worth considering. Our never, said the Germans, or never we may seize the air as once the British seized the seas, while all the other powers are still experimenting. Swift and systematic, and secret were their preparations, and their plan most excellent. So far as their knowledge went, America was the only dangerous possibility. America, which was also now the leading trade rival of Germany and one of the chief barriers to her imperial expansion. So at once they would strike at America. They would fling a great force across the Atlantic heavens, and bear America down unwarned and unprepared. Altogether it was a well-imagined, and most hopeful and spirited enterprise, having regard to the information in the possession of the German government. The chances of it being a successful surprise were very great. The airship and the flying machine were very different things from ironclads, which take a couple of years to build. Given hands, given plant, they could be made innumerably in a few weeks. Once the needful parks and foundries were organized, airships and Drachain Fliegers could be poured into the sky. Indeed, when the time came, they did pour into the sky like, as a bitter French writer put it, flies roused from filth. The attack upon America was to be the first move in this tremendous game. But no sooner had it started than instantly the aeronautic parks were to proceed to put together and inflate the second fleet which was to dominate Europe and maneuver significantly over London, Paris, Rome, St. Petersburg, or wherever else its moral effect was required. A world surprise it was to be, no less a world conquest, and it is wonderful how near the calmly adventurous minds that planned it came to succeeding in their colossal design. Von Sternberg was the Moltke of this war in the air, but it was the curious hard romanticism of Prince Karl Albert that won over the hesitating emperor to the scheme. Prince Karl Albert was indeed the central figure of the world drama. He was the darling of the imperialist spirit in German, and the ideal of the new aristocratic feeling, the new chivalry, as it was called, that followed the overthrow of socialism through its internal divisions and lack of discipline, and the concentration of wealth in the hands of a few great families. He was compared by obsequious flatterers to the Black Prince, to Alcibiades, to the young Caesar. To many he seemed Nietzsche's overman revealed. He was big, and blonde and virile, and splendidly non-moral. The first great feat that startled Europe, and almost brought about a new Trojan War, was his abduction of the Princess Helena of Norway, and his blank refusal to marry her. Then followed his marriage with Gretchen Krass, a Swiss girl of peerless beauty. Then came the gallant rescue, which almost cost him his life, of three drowning tailors whose boat had upset in the sea near Heligoland. For that and his victory over the American yacht Defender, C.C.I., the Emperor forgave him, and placed him in control of the new aeronautic arm of the German forces. This he developed with marvelous energy and ability, being resolved, as he said, to give to Germany land and sea and sky. The national passion for aggression found in him its supreme exponent, and achieved through him its realization in this astounding war. But his fascination was more than national. All over the world his ruthless strength dominated minds as the Napoleonic legend had dominated minds. Englishmen turned in disgust from the slow, complex, civilized methods of their national politics to this uncompromising, forceful figure. Frenchmen believed in him. Poems were written to him in American. He made the war. quite equally with the rest of the world. The general German population was taken by surprise by the swift vigor of the imperial government. A considerable literature of military forecasts, beginning as early as 1906 with Rudolf Martin, the author not merely of a brilliant book of anticipations, but of a proverb, "The future of Germany lies in the air," had, however, partially prepared the German imagination for some such enterprise. Two of all these world forces, and gigantic designs Bert Smallways knew nothing until he found himself in the very focus of it all, and gaped down amazed on the spectacle of that giant herd of airships. Each one seemed as long as the Strand, and as big about as Trafalgar Square. Some must have been a third of a mile in length. He had never before seen anything so vast and disciplined as this tremendous park. For the first time in his life he really had an intimation of the extraordinary and quite important things of which a contemporary may go in ignorance. He had always clung to the illusion that Germans were fat, absurd men who smoked China pipes and were addicted to knowledge and horseflesh and sauerkraut and indigestible things generally. His bird's eye view was quite transitory. He ducked at the first shot, and directly his balloon began to drop, his mind ran confusedly upon how he might explain himself, and whether he should pretend to be Butteridge or not. "Lord!" he groaned, in an agony of indecision. Then his eye caught his sandals, and he felt a spasm of self-disgust. "He'll think I'm a bloomin' idiot," he said, and then it was he rose up desperately, and threw over the sandbag, and provoked the second and third shots. It flashed into his head, as he cowered in the bottom of the car, that he might avoid all sorts of disagreeable and complicated explanations by pretending to be mad. That was his last idea before the airship seemed to rush up about him, as if to look at him, and his car hit the ground and bounded, and pitched him out on his head. He awoke to find himself famous, and to hear a voice crying, "Butteridge! Ja! Ja I air Butteridge! Selbst!" He was lying on a little patch of grass beside one of the main avenues of the aeronautic park. The airships receded down a great vista, an immense perspective, and the blunt prow of each was adorned with a black eagle of 100 feet or so spread. Down the other side of the avenue ran a series of gas generators, and big hose pipes trailed everywhere across the intervening space. Close at H, and was his now nearly deflated balloon, and the car on its side looking minutely small, a mere broken toy, a shriveled bubble, in contrast with the gigantic bulk of the nearer airship. This he saw almost end on, rising like a cliff and sloping forward towards its fellow on the other side so as to overshadow the alley between them. There was a crowd of excited people about him, big men mostly in tight uniforms. Everybody was talking, and several were shouting, in German. He knew that, because they splashed and aspirated sounds like startled kittens. Only one phrase, repeated again and again, could he recognize the name of Air Butteridge. "Gollies," said Bert. "Hey, I've spotted it." "Besser," said someone, and some rapid German followed. He perceived that close at H, and was a field telephone, and that a tall officer in blue was talking thereat about him. Another stood close beside him with a portfolio of drawings and photographs in his hand. They looked round at him. "Do you speak German, Herr Butteridge?" Bert decided that he had better be dazed. He did his best to seem thoroughly dazed. "Here am I?" he asked. Volubility prevailed. Prinz was mentioned. A bugle sounded far away, and its call was taken up by one nearer, and then by one close at hand. This seemed to increase the excitement greatly. A monorail car bumbled past. The telephone bell rang passionately, and the tall officer seemed to engage in a heated altercation. Then he approached the group about Bert, calling out something about it Bringen. An earnest-faced, emaciated man with a white mustache appealed to Bert. "Air Butteridge, sir, we are just to start." "Where am I?" Bert repeated. Someone shook him by the other shoulder. Are you Herr Booteraitch? He asked. Herr Booteraitch, we are just the start, repeated the white mustache, and then helplessly, what is the good? What can we do? The officer from the telephone repeated a sentence about Erprinz and Erprinzian. The man with the mustache stared for a moment, grasped an idea, and became violently energetic, stood up and bawled directions at unseen people. Questions were asked, and the doctor at Bert's side answered, Ja. Ja. Several times, also something about Hopf. With a certain urgency he got Bert rather unwillingly to his feet. Two huge soldiers in gray advanced upon Bert and seized hold of him. Hello, said Bert, startled. Hats up. It is all right, the doctor explained. They are to carry you. Where? Asked Bert, unanswered. Put your arms round their pals round them. Yes, but where? Hold tight. Before Bert could decide to say anything more, he was whisked up by the two soldiers. They joined hands to seat him, and his arms were put about their necks. Wie vorwärts. Someone ran before him with a portfolio, and he was borne rapidly along the broad avenue between the gas generators and the airships, rapidly and on the whole smoothly, except that once or twice his bearer stumbled over hose pipes and nearly let him down. He was wearing Mr. Butteridge's alpine cap, and his little shoulders were in Mr. Butteridge's fur-lined overcoat, and he had responded to Mr. Butteridge's name. The sandals dangled helplessly. Gah! Everybody seemed in a devil of a hurry. Why? He was carried joggling and gaping through the twilight, marveling beyond measure. The systematic arrangement of wide convenient spaces, the quantities of business-like soldiers everywhere, the occasional neat piles of material, the ubiquitous monorail lines, and the towering ship-like hulls about him, reminded him a little of impressions he had got as a boy on a visit to Woolwich Dockyard. The whole camp reflected the colossal power of modern science that had created it. A peculiar strangeness was produced by the lowness of the electric light, which lay upon the ground, casting all shadows upwards, and making a grotesque shadow figure of himself, and his bearers on the airship sides, fusing all three of them into a monstrous animal with attenuated legs, and an immense fan-like humped body. The lights were on the ground, because as far as possible all poles and standards had been dispensed with to prevent complications when the airships rose. It was deep twilight now, a tranquil blue-skied evening. Everything rose out from the splashes of light upon the ground into dim translucent tall masses. Within the cavities of the airship's small inspecting lamps glowed like cloud-veiled stars, and made them seem marvelously unsubstantial. Each airship had its name in black letters on white on either flank, and forward the Imperial Eagle sprawled, an overwhelming bird in the dimness. Bugles sounded, monorail cars of quiet soldiers slithered burbling by. The cabins under the heads of the airships were being lit up, doors opened in them, and revealed padded passages. Now and then a voice gave directions to workers indistinctly seen. There was a matter of sentinels, gangways and a long narrow passage, a scramble over a disorder of baggage, and then Bert found himself lowered to the ground, and standing in the doorway of a spacious cabin that was perhaps 10 feet square and 8 high, furnished with crimson padding and aluminium. A tall, bird-like young man with a small head, a long nose, and very pale hair, with his hands full of things like shaving strops, boot trees, hairbrushes, and toilet tidies, was saying things about God and thunder and dumber Booteraitch as Bert entered. He was apparently an evicted occupant. Then he vanished, and Bert was lying back on a couch in the corner with a pillow under his head, and the door of the cabin shut upon him. He was alone. Everybody had hurried out again astonishingly. Gollies, said Bert. Hat next? He stared about him at the room. Butteridge. Shall I try to keep it up, or shan't I? The room he was in puzzled him. Tisn't a prison and tisn't an orifice? Then the old trouble came uppermost. "Wish to even I had these silly sandals on," he cried querulously to the universe. "Hey, give the whole blessed show away." 3. His door was flung open, and a compact young man in uniform appeared, carrying Mr. Butteridge's portfolio, rucksack, and shaving glass. "I say," he said in faultless English as he entered. He had a beaming face, and a sort of pinkish blonde hair. "Fancy you being Butteridge." He slapped Bert's meager luggage down. "We'd have started," he said, "in another half hour. You didn't give yourself much time." He surveyed Bert curiously. His gaze rested for a fraction of a moment on the sandals. "Who ought to have come on your flying machine, Mr. Butteridge?" He didn't wait for an answer. "He Prince says I've got to look after you. Naturally he can't see you now, but he thinks your coming's providential. Last grace of heaven. Like a sign. Hello." He stood still and listened. Outside there was a going to and fro of feet, a sound of distant bugles suddenly taken up and echoed close at hand. Men called out in loud tones short, sharp, seemingly vital things, and were answered distantly. A bell jangled, and feet went down the corridor. Then came a stillness more distracting than sound, and then a great gurgling and rushing and splashing of water. The young man's eyebrows lifted. He hesitated, and dashed out of the room. Presently came a stupendous bang to vary the noises without, then a distant cheering. The young man reappeared. "They're running the water out of the ballonet already." "What water?" asked Bert. "The water that anchored us. Artful dodge. Eh?" Bert tried to take it in. "Of course," said the compact young man. "You don't understand." A gentle quivering crept upon Bert's senses. "Tee, that's the engine," said the compact young man approvingly. "Ah, we shan't be long." Another long listening interval. The cabin swayed. "Why, Jove! We're starting already," he cried. "We're starting." "Starting," cried Bert, sitting up. "Here?" But the young man was out of the room again. There were noises of German in the passage, and other nerve-shaking sounds. The swaying increased. The young man reappeared. "Ear off, right enough." "I say," said Bert, "where are we starting? I wish you'd explain. What's this place? I don't understand." "What?" cried the young man, "you don't understand?" "No. I'm all dazed like from that crack on the knob I got. Where are we? Where are we starting? Don't you know where you are, what this is?" "Not a bit of it. What's all the swaying and the row?" "What a lark," cried the young man. "Say, what a thundering lark. Don't you know? We're off to America, and you haven't realized. You've just caught us by a neck. You're on the blessed old flagship with the Prince. You won't miss anything. Whatever's on, you bet the Vaterland will be there." "Us? Off to America? Rather. In an airship? What do you think?" "Me? Going to America on an airship? After that balloon? Here. I say I don't want to go. I want to walk about on my legs. Let me get out." "I didn't understand." He made a dive for the door. The young man arrested Bert with a gesture, took hold of a strap, lifted up a panel in the padded wall, and a window appeared. "Look," he said. Side by side they looked out. "Gaw," said Bert. "Ear going up." "We are," said the young man, cheerfully, "fast." They were rising in the air smoothly and quietly, and moving slowly to the throb of the engine athwart the aeronautic park. Down below it stretched, dimly geometrical in the darkness, picked out at regular intervals by glowworm spangles of light. One black gap in the long line of gray, round-backed airships marked the position from which the Vaterland had come. Beside it a second monster now rose softly, released from its bonds and cables into the air. Then, taking a beautifully exact distance, a third ascended, and then a fourth. "Too late, Mr. Butteridge," the young man remarked. "Ear off. I dare say it is a bit of a shock to you, but there you are. The Prince said you'd have to come. Look here, said Bert. I really am dazed. What's this thing? Where are we going? This, Mr. Butteridge, said the young man, taking pains to be explicit, is an airship. It's the flagship of Prince Karl Albert. This is the German air fleet, and it is going over to America, to give that spirited people what for. The only thing we were at all uneasy about was your invention. And here you are. But, you a German? Asked Bert. Lieutenant Kurt. Luftlieutenant Kurt, at your service. But you speak English. Mother was English, went to school in England. Afterwards, Rhodes Scholar. German nonetheless for that. Detailed for the present, Mr. Butteridge, to look after you. You're shaken by your fall. It's all right, really. They're going to buy your machine and everything. You sit down, and take it quite calmly. You'll soon get the hang of the position. Four, Bert sat down on the locker, collecting his mind, and the young man talked to him about the airship. He was really a very tactful young man indeed, in a natural sort of way. Airsay, all this is new to you, he said. Not your sort of machine. These cabins aren't half bad. He got up and walked around the little apartment, showing its points. Here is the bed, he said, whipping down a couch from the wall, and throwing it back again with a click. Here are toilet things, and he opened a neatly arranged cupboard. Not much washing. No water we've got. No water at all except for drinking. No baths or anything until we get to America and land. Rub over with loofah. 1 pint of hot for shaving. That's all. In the locker below you are rugs and blankets. You will need them presently. They say it gets cold. I don't know. Never been up before. Except a little work with gliders, which is mostly going down. 3/4 of the chaps in the fleet haven't. Here's a folding chair and table behind the door. Compact, eh? He took the chair and balanced it on his little finger. Ready light, eh? Aluminium and magnesium alloy and a vacuum inside. All these cushions stuffed with hydrogen. Foxy. The whole ship's like that. And not a man in the fleet, except the prince and one or two others, over 11 stone. Couldn't sweat the prince, you know. We'll go all over the thing tomorrow. I'm frightfully keen on it. He beamed at Bert. You do look young, he remarked. Always thought you'd be an old man with a beard, a sort of philosopher. I don't know why one should expect clever people always to be old. I do. Bert parried that compliment a little awkwardly, and then the lieutenant was struck with the riddle why Herr Butteridge had not come in his own flying machine. It's a long story, said Bert. Look here. He said abruptly, I wish you'd lend me a pair of slippers, or something. I'm regular sick of these sandals. They're rotten things. I've been trying them for a friend. Righto. The ex-Rhodes Scholar whisked out of the room, and reappeared with a considerable choice of footwear pumps, cloth bath slippers, and a purple pair adorned with golden sunflowers. But these he repented of at the last moment. I don't even wear them myself, he said. Oh, only brought them in the zeal of the moment. He laughed confidentially. Adam worked for me in Oxford. By a friend. Take them everywhere. So Bert chose the pumps. The lieutenant broke into a cheerful snigger. Here we are trying on slippers, he said, and the world going by like a panorama below. Rather a lark, eh? Look. Bert peeped with him out of the window, looking from the bright pettiness of the red and silver cabin into a dark immensity. The land below, except for a lake, was black and featureless, and the other airships were hidden. More outside, said the lieutenant. Let's go. There's a sort of little gallery. He led the way into the long passage, which was lit by one small electric light, past some notices in German, to an open balcony and a light ladder and gallery of metal, lattice overhanging, empty space. Bert followed his leader down to the gallery slowly and cautiously. From it he was able to watch the wonderful spectacle of the first air fleet flying through the night. They flew in a wedge-shaped formation, the Vaterland I-stand leading, the tail receding into the corners of the sky. They flew in long, regular undulations, great dark fish-like shapes, showing hardly any light at all, the engines making a throbbing sound that was very audible out on the gallery. They were going at a level of 5 or 6,000 feet, and rising steadily. Below, the country lay silent, a clear darkness dotted and lined out with clusters of furnaces, and the lit streets of a group of big towns. The world seemed to lie in a bowl, the overhanging bulk of the airship above hid all but the lowest levels of the sky. They watched the landscape for a space. "Jolly it must be to invent things," said the lieutenant suddenly. "How did you come to think of your machine first?" "Worked it out," said Bert, after a pause. "Est ground away at it. Our people are frightfully keen on you. They thought the British had got you. Weren't the British keen?" "In a way," said Bert. "Till it's a long story. I think it's an immense thing to invent. I couldn't invent a thing to save my life." They both fell silent, watching the darkened world and following their thoughts until a bugle summoned them to a belated dinner. Bert was suddenly alarmed. "Aren't you of a to dress and things?" he said. "I've always been too hard at science and things, to go into society and all that." "No fear," said Kurt. "And nobody's got more than the clothes they wear. We're traveling light. You might perhaps take your overcoat off. They've an electric radiator each end of the room." And so presently Bert found himself sitting, to eat in the presence of the Herman Alexander, that great and puissant prince, Prince Karl Albert, the warlord, the hero of two hemispheres. He was a handsome, blonde man, with deep-set eyes, a snub nose, upturned mustache, and long white hands, a strange-looking man. He sat higher than the others, under a black eagle with widespread wings and the German imperial flags. He was, as it were, enthroned, and it struck Bert greatly that as he ate he did not look at people, but over their heads like one who sees visions. 20 officers of various ranks stood about the table and Bert. They all seemed extremely curious to see the famous Butteridge, and their astonishment at his appearance was ill-controlled. The prince gave him a dignified salutation, to which, by an inspiration, he bowed. Standing next the prince was a brown-faced, wrinkled man with silver spectacles and fluffy, dingy gray side whiskers, who regarded Bert with a peculiar and disconcerting attention. The company sat after ceremonies Bert could not understand. At the other end of the table was the Bert-faced officer Bert had dispossessed, still looking hostile and whispering about Bert to his neighbor. Two soldiers waited. The dinner was a plain one, a soup, some fresh mutton, and cheese, and there was very little talk. A curious solemnity indeed brooded over everyone. Partly this was reaction after the intense toil and restrained excitement of starting, partly it was the overwhelming sense of strange new experiences, of portentous adventure. The prince was lost in thought. He roused himself to drink to the emperor in champagne, and the company cried, "Hotch!" like men repeating responses in church. No smoking was permitted, but some of the officers went down to the little open gallery to chew tobacco. No lights whatever were safe amidst that bundle of inflammable things. Bert suddenly fell yawning and shivering. He was overwhelmed by a sense of his own insignificance amidst these great rushing monsters of the air. He felt life was as too big for him, too much for him altogether. He said something to Kurt about his head, went up the steep ladder from the swaying little gallery into the airship again, and so, as if it were a refuge, to bed. 5. Bert slept for a time, and then his sleep was broken by dreams. Mostly he was fleeing from formless terrors down an interminable passage in an airship, a passage paved at first with ravenous trapdoors, and then with openwork canvas of the most careless description. "Gaw," said Bert, turning over after his 7th fall through infinite space that night. He sat up in the darkness and nursed his knees. The progress of the airship was not nearly so smooth as a balloon. He he could feel a regular swaying up, up, up and then down, 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 and the throbbing and tremulous quiver of the engines. His mind began to teem with memories and more. Through them, like a struggling swimmer in broken water, came the perplexing question, what am I to do tomorrow? Tomorrow, Kurt had told him, the prince's secretary, the Graf von Winterfeld, would come to him and discuss his flying machine, and then he would see the prince. He would have to stick it out now that he was Butteridge, and sell his invention. And then, if they found him out, he had a vision of infuriated Butteridges, suppose after all he owned up, pretended it was their misunderstanding. He began to scheme devices for selling the secret and circumventing Butteridge. What should he ask for the thing? Somehow £20,000 struck him as about the sum indicated. He fell into that despondency that lies in wait in the small hours. He had got too big a job on too big a job. Memory swamped his scheming. Where was I this time last night? He recapitulated his evenings tediously and lengthily. Last night he had been up above the clouds in Butteridge's balloon. He thought of the moment when he dropped through them and saw the cold twilight sea close below. He still remembered that disagreeable incident with a nightmare vividness. And the night before he and Grubb had been looking for cheap lodgings at Littlestone in Kent. How remote that seemed now. It might be years ago. For the first time he thought of his fellow desert dervish, left with the two red-painted bicycles on Dymchurch sands. He won't make much of a show of it, not without me. Anyo he did ave the treasury such as it was in his pocket. The night before that was bank holiday night and they had sat discussing their minstrel enterprise, drawing up a program and rehearsing steps. And the night before was Whitsunday. Lord! Cried Bert, what a doing that motor bicycle give me! He recalled the empty flapping of the eviscerated cushion, the feeling of impotence as the flames rose again. From among the confused memories of that tragic flare one little figure emerged very bright and poignantly sweet, Edna, crying back reluctantly from the departing motor car, see you tomorrow, Bert! Other memories of Edna clustered round that impression. They led Bert's mind step by step to an agreeable state that found expression in L.L. Marrier, if she don't look out. And then in a flash it followed in his mind that if he sold the Butteridge secret he could. Suppose after all he did get £20,000, such sums have been paid. With that he could buy house and garden, buy new clothes beyond dreaming, buy a motor, travel, have every delight of the civilized life as he knew it, for himself and Edna. Of course, risks were involved. LL ave old Butteridge on my track, I expect. He meditated upon that. He declined again to despondency. As yet he was only in the beginning of the adventure. He had still to deliver the goods and draw the cash. And before that just now he was by no means on his way home. He was flying off to America to fight there. Not much fighting, he considered. All our own way. Still, if a shell did happen to hit the Vaterland on the underside, suppose I ought to make my will. He lay back for some time composing wills chiefly in favor of Edna. He had settled now it was to be £20,000. He left a number of minor legacies. The wills became more and more meandering and extravagant. He woke from the 8th repetition of his nightmare fall through space. His flying gets on one's nerves, he said. He could feel the airship diving down, 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 then slowly swinging to up, up, up. Throb, 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 quivered the engine. He got up presently and wrapped himself about with Mr. Butteridge's overcoat and all the blankets, for the air was very keen. Then he peeped out of the window to see a gray dawn breaking over clouds, then turned up his light, and bolted his door, sat down to the table, and produced his chest protector. He smoothed the crumpled plans with his hand, and contemplated them. Then he referred to the other drawings in the portfolio. £20,000. If he worked it right, it was worth trying, anyhow. Presently he opened the drawer in which Kurt had put paper and writing materials. Bert Smallways was by no means a stupid person, and up to a certain limit he had not been badly educated. His board school had taught him to draw up to certain limits, taught him to calculate and understand a specification. If at that point his country had tired of its efforts, and handed him over unfinished to scramble for a living in an atmosphere of advertisements and individual enterprise, that was really not his fault. He was as his state had made him, and the reader must not imagine, because he was a little cockney cad, that he was absolutely incapable of grasping the idea of the Butteridge flying machine. But he found it stiff and perplexing. His motor bicycle and Grubbs experiments, and the mechanical drawing he had done in Standard 7 all helped him out, and, moreover, the maker of these drawings, whoever he was, had been anxious to make his intentions plain. Bert copied sketches, he made notes, he made a quite tolerable and intelligent copy of the essential drawings and sketches of the others. Then he fell into a meditation upon them. At last he rose with a sigh, folded up the originals that had formerly been in his chest protector, and put them into the breast pocket of his jacket, and then very carefully deposited the copies he had made in the place of the originals. He had no very clear plan in his mind in doing this, except that he hated the idea of altogether parting with the secret. For a long time he meditated, profoundly nodding. Then he turned out his light, and went to bed again, and schemed himself to sleep. 6. The Hitchgebrun Graf von Winterfeld was also a light sleeper that night, but then he was one of these people who sleep little, and play chess problems in their heads, to while away the time, and that night he had a particularly difficult problem to solve. He came in upon Bert, while he was still in bed in the glow of the sunlight reflected from the North Sea below, consumed the rolls and coffee a soldier had brought him. He had a portfolio under his arm, and in the clear early morning light his dingy gray hair and heavy, silver-rimmed spectacles made him look almost benevolent. He spoke English fluently, but with a strong German flavor. He was particularly bad with his S, and his H's softened towards weak DS. He called Bert explosively, Puderich. He began with some indistinct civilities, bowed, took a folding table and chair from behind the door, put the former between himself and Bert, sat down on the latter, coughed dryly, and opened his portfolio. Then he put his elbows on the table, pinched his lower lip with his two forefingers, and regarded Bert disconcertingly with magnified eyes. "Who came to us, Herr Puderich, against your will?" he said at last. "How do you make that out?" asked Bert, after a pause of astonishment. "I chose by the maps in your car. They were all English. And your provisions. They were all picnic. Also your cords were entangled. You have been tugging but no good. You could not manage the balloon, and another power than yours brought you to us. Is it not so?" Bert thought. "Also, where is the lady?" "Here." "What lady?" "You started with a lady. That is evident. You started for an afternoon excursion, a picnic. A man of your temperament, he would take a lady. She was not with you in your balloon when you came down at Dornoff." "No. Only her jacket. It is your affair. Still, I am curious." Bert reflected. "How do you know that?" "I judge by the nature of your various provisions. I cannot account, Mr. Puderich, for the lady, what you have done with her. Nor can I tell why you should wear nature sandals, nor why you should wear such cheap blue clothes. These are outside my instructions. Trifles, perhaps. Officially they are to be ignored. Ladies come and go, I am a man of the world. I have known wise men wear sandals and even practice vegetarian habits. I have known men, or at any rate, I have known chemists who did not smoke. You have, no doubt, put the lady down somewhere. Well, let us get to business." A higher power, his voice changed its emotional quality, his magnified eye seemed to dilate, as brought you, and your secret straight to us. So, he bowed his head opiate. It is the destiny of Germany and my prince. I can understand you always carry that secret. You are afraid of robbers and spies. So it comes with you to us. Mr. Puderich, Germany will buy it. Will she? She will, said the secretary, looking hard at Bert's abandoned sandals in the corner of the locker. He roused himself, consulted a paper of notes for a moment, and Bert eyed his brown, unwrinkled face with expectation and terror. Hermione, I am instructed to say, said the secretary, with his eyes on the table and his notes spread out, has always been willing to buy your secret. We have indeed been eager to acquire it, very eager, and it was only the fear that you might be, on patriotic grounds, acting in collusion with your British War Office that has made us discreet in offering for your marvelous invention through intermediaries. We have no hesitation whatever now, I am instructed, in agreeing to your proposal of £100,000. Crikey, said Bert, overwhelmed. I beg your pardon? Just a twinge, said Bert, raising his hand to his bandaged head. Ah, also I am instructed to say that as for that noble, unrightly accused lady you have championed so bravely against British hypocrisy and coldness, all the chivalry of Germany is on her side. Lady? Said Bert faintly, and then recalled the great Butteridge love story. Had the old chap also read the letters? He must think him a scorcher if he had. Oh, that's all right, he said, about her. I hadn't any doubts about that. He stopped. The secretary certainly had a most appalling stare. It seemed ages before he looked down again. L.Z. lady as you please. She is your affair. I have performed my instructions. And the title of Baron, that also can be done. It can all be done, Herr Puderich. He drummed on the table for a second or so, and resumed. Have to tell you, sir, that you come to us at a crisis in Weltpolitik. There can be no harm now for me to put our plans before you. Before you leave this ship again they will be manifest to all the world. War is perhaps already declared. We go to America. Our fleet will descend out of the air upon the United States. It is a country quite unprepared for war everywhere. They have always relied on the Atlantic and their navy. We have selected a certain point that is at present the secret of our commanders which we shall seize, and then we shall establish a depot, a sort of inland Gibraltar. It will be, what will it be? An eagle's nest. There our airships will gather and repair, and thence they will fly to and fro over the United States, terrorizing cities, dominating Washington, levying what is necessary, until the terms we dictate are accepted. You follow me? Go on, said Bert. We could have done all this with such Luftschiff and Drachenflieger as we possess, but the accession of your machine renders our project complete. It not only gives us a better Drachenflieger, but it removes our last uneasiness as to Great Britain. Without you, sir, Great Britain, the land you loathed so well, and that has requited you so ill, that land of Pharisees and reptiles, can do nothing. Nothing. You see, I am perfectly frank with you. Well, I am instructed that Germany recognizes all this. We want you to place yourself at our disposal. We want you to become our chief head flight engineer. We want you to manufacture, we want to equip a swarm of hornets under your direction. We want you to direct this force. And it is at our depot in America we want you. So we offer you simply, and without haggling, the full terms you demanded weeks ago, £100,000 in cash, a salary of £3,000 a year, a pension of £1,000 a year, and the title of Baron as you desired. These are my instructions. He resumed his scrutiny of Bert's face. That's all right, of course, said Bert, a little short of breath, but otherwise resolute and calm, and it seemed to him that now was the time to bring his nocturnal scheming to the issue. The secretary contemplated Bert's collar with sustained attention. Only for one moment did his gaze move to the sandals and back. Jess is lemthing a bit, said Bert, finding the stare debilitating. Akira, he said at last, with an air of great explicitness, I got the secret. Yes. But I don't want the name of Butteridge to appear, see? I've been thinking that over. A little delicacy? Exactly. You buy the secret leastways, I give it you from bearer, see? His voice failed him a little, and the stare continued. Want to do the thing anonymously. See? Still staring. Bert drifted on like a swimmer caught by a current. Act is, I'm going to add up the name of Smallways. I don't want no title of Baron. I've altered my mind. And I want the money quiet-like. I want the £100,000 paid into banks, £30,000 into the London and County Bank branch at Bun Hill in Kent directly, I, and over the plans, £20,000 into the Bank of England, arf the rest into a good French bank, the other arf the German National Bank, see? I want it put there, right away. I don't want it put in the name of Butteridge. I want it put in the name of Albert Peter Smallways. That's the name I'm going to add up. That's condition one. Go on, said the secretary. The next condition, said Bert, is that you don't make any inquiries as to title. I mean what English gentlemen do when they sell or let you land. You don't arst how I got it. See? Here I am, I deliver you the goods, that's all right. Some people have the cheek to say this isn't my invention, see? It is, you know, that's all right, but I don't want that gone into. I want a fair and square agreement saying that's all right. See? His E faded into a profound silence. The secretary sighed at last, leant back in his chair, and produced a toothpick, and used it to assist his meditation on Bert's case. Hat was that name? He asked at last, putting away the toothpick. I must write it down. Albert Peter Smallways, said Bert, in a mild tone. The secretary wrote it down, after a little difficulty about the spelling, because of the different names of the letters of the alphabet in the two languages. And now, Mr. Smallways, he said at last, leaning back and resuming the stare, tell me, how did you get hold of Mr. Pooterage's balloon? 7. When at last the Graf von Winterfold left Bert Smallways, he left him in an extremely deflated condition, with all his little story told. He had, as people say, made a clean breast of it. He had been pursued in two details. He had had to explain the blue suit, the sandals, the desert dervishes, everything. For a time, scientific zeal consumed the secretary, and the question of the plans remained in suspense. He even went into speculation about the previous occupants of the balloon. Suppose, he said, the lady was the lady. But that is not our affair. It is very curious and amusing, yes. But I am afraid the prince may be at it. He acted with his usual decision, always he acts with wonderful decision. Like Napoleon. Directly he was told of your descent into the camp at Dornoff, he said, bring him. Bring him. It is my star. Apostrophe his star of destiny. You see? He will be thwarted. He directed you to come as Herr Pooterage, and you have not done so. You have tried, of course, but it has been a poor try. His judgments of men are very just and right, and it is better for men to act up to them completely. Especially now. Particularly now. He resumed that attitude of his, with his underlip pinched between his forefingers. He spoke almost confidentially. Tea will be awkward. I tried to suggest some doubt, but I was overruled. The prince does not listen. He is impatient in the high air. Perhaps he will think his star has been making a fool of him. Perhaps he will think I have been making a fool of him. He wrinkled his forehead, and drew in the corners of his mouth. I got the plans, said Bert. Yes. There is that. Yes. But you see, the prince was interested in Herr Pooterage, because of his romantic seat. Herr Pooterage was so much more, in the picture. I am afraid you are not equal to controlling the flying machine department of our aerial park as he wished you to do. He had promised himself that. And there was also the prestige, the world prestige of Pooterage with us. Well, we must see what we can do. He held out his hand. If me the plans. A terrible chill ran through the being of Mr. Smallways. To this day he is not clear in his mind, whether he wept or no, but certainly there was weeping in his voice. Here, I say. He protested. Ain't I to have nothing for him? The secretary regarded him with benevolent eyes. Who do not deserve a nicing? He said. I might have tore him up. They are not yours. They weren't Butteridge's. No need to pay a nicing. Bert's being seemed to tighten towards desperate deeds. Ah, he said, clutching his coat, ain't there? Pegom, said the secretary. Listen, you shall have £500. You shall have it on my promise. I will do that for you, and that is all I can do. Take it from me. Give me the name of that bank. Write it down. So, I tell you the prince is no joke. I do not think he approved of your appearance last night. No, I can't answer for him. He wanted Pooterage, and you have spoiled it. The prince I do not understand quite, he is in a strange state. It is the excitement of the starting, and this great soaring in the air. I cannot account for what he does. But if all goes well I will see to it, you shall have £500. Will that do? Then give me the plans. Old beggar, said Bert, as the door clicked. Ah, what an ole beggar. Sharp. He sat down in the folding chair, and whistled noiselessly for a time. Nice old swindle for him, if I tore him up. I could have. He rubbed the bridge of his nose thoughtfully. Gave the whole blessed show away. If I just kept quiet about being anonymous. Gaw. Too soon, Bert, my boy, too soon and too rushy. I'd like to kick my silly self. I couldn't have kept it up. After all, it ain't so very bad, he said. After all, £500. It isn't my secret, anyhow. It's just as a pickup on the road. 500. Wonder what the fare is from America back home? 8. And later in the day an extremely shattered and disorganized Bert Smallways stood in the presence of the Prince Carl Albert. The proceedings were in German. The prince was in his own cabin, the end room of the airship, a charming apartment furnished in wickerwork with a long window across its entire breadth, looking forward. He was sitting at a folding table of green baize, with von Winterfeld and two officers sitting beside him, and littered before them was a number of American maps, and Mr. Butteridge's letters and his portfolio, and a number of loose papers. Bert was not asked to sit down, and remained standing throughout the interview. Von Winterfeld told his story, and every now and then the words Balin and Pooterage struck on Bert's ears. The prince's face remained stern and ominous, and the two officers watched it cautiously, or glanced at Bert. There was something a little strange in their scrutiny of the prince, a curiosity, an apprehension. Then presently he was struck by an idea, and they fell discussing the plans. The prince asked Bert abruptly in English, did you ever see this thing go up? Bert jumped. Odd from Bun Hill, your royal highness. Von Winterfeld made some explanation. How fast did it go? Couldn't say, your royal highness. The papers, leastways the Daily Courier, said 80 miles an hour. They talked German over that for a time. Could it stand still? Up in the air? That is what I want to know. It could hover, your royal highness, like a wasp, said Bert. Feel better, Nicoir? Said the prince to von Winterfeld, and then went on in German for a time. Presently they came to an end, and the two officers looked at Bert. One rang a bell, and the portfolio was handed to an attendant, who took it away. Then they reverted to the case of Bert, and it was evident the prince was inclined to be hard with him. Von Winterfeld protested. Apparently theological considerations came in, for there were several mentions of it. Some conclusions emerged, and it was apparent that von Winterfeld was instructed to convey them to Bert. Mr. Schmalvase, you have obtained a footing in this airship, he said, by disgraceful and systematic lying. Hardly systematic, said Bert. The prince silenced him by a gesture. And it is within the power of His Highness to dispose of you as a spy. Here. I came to sell SSH, said one of the officers. However, in consideration of the happy chance that may be the instrument under God of this Puderich flying machine reaching His Highness's hand, you have been spared. Yes, you were the bearer of good tidings. You will be allowed to remain on this ship until it is convenient to dispose of you. Do you understand? We will bring him, said the prince, and added terribly with a terrible glare, as ballast. You are to come with us, said Winterfeld, as ballast. Do you understand? Bert opened his mouth to ask about the £500, and then a saving gleam of wisdom silenced him. He met von Winterfeld's eye, and it seemed to him the secretary nodded slightly. Go, said the prince, with a sweep of the great arm and hand towards the door. Bert went out like a leaf before a gale. 9. But in between the time when the Graf von Winterfeld had talked to him and this alarming conference with the prince, Bert had explored the Vaterland from end to end. He had found it interesting in spite of grave preoccupations. Kurt, like the greater number of the men upon the German air fleet, had known hardly anything of aeronautics before his appointment to the new flagship. But he was extremely keen upon this wonderful new weapon Germany had assumed so suddenly and dramatically. He showed things to Bert with a boyish eagerness and appreciation. It was as if he showed them, over again to himself, like a child showing a new toy. Let's go all over the ship, he said with zest. He pointed out particularly the lightness of everything, the use of exhausted aluminium tubing, of springy cushions inflated with compressed hydrogen. The partitions were hydrogen bags covered with light imitation leather, the very crockery was a light biscuit glazed in a vacuum, and weighed next to nothing. Where strength was needed there was the new Charlottenburg alloy, German steel as it was called, the toughest and most resistant metal in the world. There was no lack of space. Space did not matter, so long as load did not grow. The habitable part of the ship was 250 feet long, and the rooms in two tiers. Above these one could go up in two remarkable little white metal turrets with big windows and airtight double doors that enabled one to inspect the vast cavity of the gas chambers. This inside view impressed Bert very much. He had never realized before that an airship was not one simple continuous gas bag containing nothing but gas. Now he saw far above him the backbone of the apparatus and its big ribs, like the neural and hemal canals, said Kurt, who had dabbled in biology. Rather, said Bert appreciatively, though he had not the ghost of an idea what these phrases meant. Little electric lights could be switched on up there, if anything went wrong in the night. There were even ladders across the space. But you can't go into the gas, protested Bert. You can't breathe it. The lieutenant opened a cupboard door and displayed a diver's suit, only that it was made of oiled silk, and both its compressed air knapsack and its helmet were of an alloy of aluminium and some light metal. He can go all over the inside netting and stick up bullet holes or leaks, he explained. There's netting inside and out. The whole outer case is rope ladder, so to speak. Aft of the habitable part of the airship was the magazine of explosives, coming near the middle of its length. They were all bombs of various types, mostly in glass. None of the German airships carried any guns at all except one small pom-pom, to use the old English nickname dating from the Boer War, which was forward in the gallery upon the shield at the heart of the eagle. From the magazine amidships a covered canvas gallery with aluminium treads on its floor and a hand rope ran back underneath the gas chamber to the engine room at the tail, but along this Bert did not go, and from first to last he never saw the engines. but he went up a ladder against a gale of ventilation, a ladder that was encased in a kind of gas-tight fire escape, and ran right athwart the great forward air chamber to the little lookout gallery with a telephone, that gallery that bore the light pom-pom of German steel and its locker of shells. This gallery was all of aluminium-magnesium alloy, the tight front of the airship swelled cliff-like above and below, and the Black Eagle sprawled overwhelmingly gigantic, its extremities all hidden by the bulge of the gas bag. And far down, under the soaring eagles, was England, 4,000 feet below perhaps, and looking very small and defenseless indeed in the morning sunlight. The realization that there was England gave Bert sudden and unexpected qualms of patriotic compunction. He was struck by a quite novel idea. After all, he might have torn up those plans and thrown them away. These people could not have done so very much to him. And even if they did, ought not an Englishman to die for his country? It was an idea that had hitherto been rather smothered up by the cares of a competitive civilization. He became violently depressed. He ought, he perceived, to have seen it in that light before. Why hadn't he seen it in that light before? Indeed, wasn't he a sort of traitor? He wondered how the aerial fleet must look from down there. Tremendous, no doubt, and dwarfing all the buildings. He was passing between Manchester and Liverpool, Kurt told him. A gleaming band across the prospect was the ship canal, and a weltering ditch of shipping far away ahead, the Mersey estuary. Bert was a southerner. He had never been north of the Midland counties, and the multitude of factories and chimneys, the latter for the most part obsolete and smokeless now, superseded by huge electric generating stations that consumed their own reek old railway viaducts, monorail networks and goods yards, and the vast areas of dingy homes and narrow streets, spreading aimlessly, struck him as though Camberwell and Rotherhithe he had run to seed. Here and there, as if caught in a net, were fields and agricultural fragments. It was a sprawl of undistinguished population. There were, no doubt, museums and town halls, and even cathedrals of a sort, to mark theoretical centers of municipal and religious organization in this confusion. But Bert could not see them, they did not stand out at all in that wide disorderly vision of congested workers' houses and places to work, and shops and meanly conceived chapels and churches. And across this landscape of an industrial civilization swept the shadows of the German airships like a hurrying shoal of fishes. Kurt and he fell talking of aerial tactics, and presently went down to the under gallery in order that Bert might see the Drachenflieger that the airships of the right wing had picked up overnight, and were towing behind them, each airship towing three or four. They looked like big box kites of an exaggerated form, soaring at the ends of invisible cords. They had long, square heads and flattened tails, with lateral propellers. Much skill is required for those. Much skill. Rather. Pause. Your machine is different from that, Mr. Butteridge? Quite different, said Bert. Or like an insect, and less like a bird. And it buzzes, and don't drive about so. What can those things do? Kurt was not very clear upon that himself, and was still explaining when Bert was called to the conference we have recorded with the Prince. And after that was over, the last traces of Butteridge fell from Bert like a garment, and he became smallways to all on board. The soldiers ceased to salute him, and the officers ceased to seem aware of his existence, except Lieutenant Kurt. He was turned out of his nice cabin, and packed in with his belongings, to share that of Lieutenant Kurt, whose luck it was to be junior, and the bird-headed officer, still swearing slightly, and carrying strops and aluminium boot trees, and weightless hairbrushes and hand mirrors and pomade in his hands, resumed possession. Bert was put in with Kurt, because there was nowhere else for him to lay his bandaged head in that close-packed vessel. He was to mess, he was told, with the men. Kurt came and stood with his legs wide apart and surveyed him for a moment as he sat despondent in his new quarters. What's your real name, then? said Kurt, who was only imperfectly informed of the new state of affairs. Smallways. I thought you were a bit of a fraud, even when I thought you were Butteridge. You're jolly lucky the prince took it calmly. He's a pretty tidy blazer when he's roused. He wouldn't stick a moment at pitching a chap of your sort overboard, if he thought fit. No, they've shoved you onto me, but it's my cabin, you know. I won't forget, said Bert. Kurt left him, and when he came to look about him the first thing he saw pasted on the padded wall was a reproduction of the great picture by Siegfried Schmalz of the war god, that terrible, trampling figure with the Viking helmet and the scarlet cloak, wading through destruction, sword in hand, which had so strong a resemblance to Carl Albert, the prince it was painted to please. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.